Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 172. It's Monday, July 18th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I'm going to start off with COVID-19 again. It seems to be on the rise, and I'm not sure everybody's paying that close attention. But I want to start with just one story that gives us an idea of where we may be headed. This from the San Francisco Chronicle. Bay Area wastewater survey suggests COVID surge could be biggest yet. Surveys of coronavirus levels in Bay Area wastewater suggest the region's relentless spring COVID surge probably rivals the winter Omicron wave in terms of the number of people currently infected. In fact, this surge may be the largest yet in some places. But capturing the scale of disease and conveying to the public the relative risk of getting sick is becoming increasingly tricky, health experts say. In all previous surges, the level of coronavirus detected in wastewater closely matched case counts when plotted on a curve. In the Omicron winter, for example, both wastewater virus levels and reported case counts started to spike sharply in mid-December, peaked over a period of a few weeks, and quickly plummeted. This spring surge broke that pattern. For the first time, case counts and viral levels have diverged. Over the past 2 months in particular, viral levels in the wastewater shot up again, while reported cases have climbed at a much slower pace. The two metrics and their disparate portraits of what's happening in the Bay Area underscore the challenges of tracking COVID as the region lurches through its third year of the pandemic. People must take into account an array of data points, from wastewater surveillance and case counts of hospitalizations, and even anecdotal reports among friends, to understand their personal risk of becoming infected and decide what precautions to take. Wastewater surveillance says there's lots more disease out there than what we see in the case counts, says Dr. George Rutherford, an infectious disease expert at UC San Francisco. People should be interpreting this as there is risk out there, and if they enter crowded indoor settings or even very crowded outdoor settings, they need to be careful. Pick and choose what you want to do. Use your mask. Wastewater surveillance is considered more reliable than other means of tracking COVID, in part because there's no human interference. Some amount of virus is excreted when a person is infected, and everyone's poop ends up in the sewage. Tracking the virus in wastewater isn't dependent on people deciding to get tested or where they do it. Other metrics like COVID hospitalizations and the rate of tests coming out positive can also be used to gauge the size of a surge, but they also have shortcomings. Hospitalizations lag behind cases as much as a week or two, so aren't great for understanding what is happening in the moment, and they paint an incomplete picture of how many infections are actually in the community, especially now that so many fewer COVID patients end up in the hospital thanks to vaccines. The positive test rate is somewhat more reliable, but it too can be influenced by human bias. People are more likely to get tested if they have symptoms, for starters, or if they already have a positive result on a home test. It's important for people to continue to practice all the strategies: testing, wearing face coverings, getting vaccinated and boosted if you haven't already, to reduce their risk. Okay, well, let's move on to the local COVID update for Lucas County. Get some context. Cases nationally are making a move upward as the BA4 and BA5 replace earlier variants, and this trend also seems to have come to Ohio. Lucas County has moved up into the newer CDC community classification for risk to medium, but this is actually due to the number of hospitalizations, which is harder to avoid getting reported, than the number of cases, although we're seeing those go up as well. The Lucas County average daily number of cases reported has gone up to 94 a day on average from 69 the week before, and the testing positivity rates have actually, the reporting is getting really bad on these. They're lagging like a week or more in some cases. But it looks like nationally it's about 18%. In Ohio, it's about 19%. In Lucas County, it's about 16%. All of these are going up everywhere. Speaking of bad data, let's look at the nursing home data, the long-term care facility active cases that are reported for nursing homes in Lucas County. I notice that it looks like they're not doing new data every week. We had the exact number of total cases and the exact number of residents and staff the last 2 weeks, and then the previous 2 weeks were exactly the same. Now, it went down, but this is data that's basically probably 3 weeks old now. And I went to the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which has the main database, and it's so complicated I couldn't even figure out how to get the Lucas County data. I used to be able to do that, but that's not easily accessible now. So it looks like the local report is going to be getting shorter as less and less data is available. But important data that is available is that hospitalizations in the U.S. continue to rise, up about 20% over the last 2 weeks. And it looks like that trend has come to Ohio as well. It looked like Ohio was faring a little bit better, but with this BA.4/5 wave, it looks like Ohio is in the thick of it as well, and is probably only going to go up for some time. And as a sign of the fact that this has been brewing for a while, hospitalizations have been slowly rising for months, actually. The deaths nationally reached an average of over 400 per day for the first time in months. This has held very steadily around 350 or so, a little higher, a little lower, but this is the first time it's cracked 400 on average, a weekly average, a daily average for the last week. So that is not good news. Bottom line for me is when I go into crowded indoor spaces, wear a good mask. Okay, well, now I'd like to move to some rankings of how Toledo and Ohio cities are doing on some health indicators. This first one is from the American College of Sports Medicine, which puts out the American Fitness Index rankings. And they did it for the top 100 largest cities, and Toledo tied for 83rd. That's bad, not good. That's close to the bottom. And they had a whole range of metrics that they use, that a set that gave a scoring for personal health ranking, how individuals' health is, and then they had another ranking for basically community factors and the environment that are conducive to fitness. Now, there was quite a disparity in this. Toledo ranked 98th out of 100 on the personal health rank, so we're doing very poorly as far as how health outcomes and personal health behaviors. But we did a little bit better on the community environment health ranking at 35th out of 100. But the total ranking was tied for 83rd. And there's two other Ohio cities that fit in this top 100. Both of them ranked better than us. Cleveland ranked 55th with a personal health ranking of 81, and again, a disparate. They did very well on the community environment health ranking at ranking 9th. So Cleveland had a ranking of 55th out of 100. So middle of the packish. Columbus did actually worse, ranked 76. They ranked 80 out of 100 on the personal health ranking of the 100 largest cities, and 48th on the community environment ranking. So it looks like Toledo is not doing that well according to this measure, and it looks like Ohio cities are in the bottom half as well. Now let's move to a different measure. This from WalletHub. The most stressed U.S. cities, according to WalletHub. For the list, researchers compared 182 U.S. cities, including the 150 most populated cities in the country. They assessed at least two of the most populated cities in each state. Researchers looked only at the city proper. They did not factor in the surrounding metro areas. To calculate the rankings, researchers examined 40 relevant metrics across four key indicators. Work stress, including average hours in the work week, job security, traffic congestion, and income growth. Financial stress, including median annual household income, median credit score, poverty rate, and affordability of housing. Family stress, including separation and divorce rates, share of single parents, and costs of child care. Health and safety stress, including the percentage of adults in fair or poor health, metrics of mental health, the insured rate, and the crime rate per capita. Well, folks, again, Ohio did not fare very well. But who fared the worst in Ohio and the nation? Cleveland, ranked as the number one stress city. And who gets second place in Ohio? Toledo, coming in number 10th out of these 182 cities and the 150 most populated cities in the country. Ohio did not fare too well at all. Other cities ranking in the bottom third. Akron was 16 out of the 150 most populated cities, Cincinnati 21, and Columbus 47. So there you go. We round out the top 10 of most stressed cities in the nation. Okay, well, perhaps adding to that stress and poor health outcomes, I want to do four stories here, a little bit of roundup and living in a post-Roe America. This first one from MedPage Today. Post-Roe health inequities will be exacerbated, experts say. One of the major implications of the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization decision is that it will exacerbate health inequalities, said Camille Bousset, a senior fellow in economic studies and governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Bousset and colleagues wrote that the Dobbs decision would not only restrict access to reproductive health, but also fuel a public health syndemic, that's an S-Y-N-demic, characterized by disease clusters that are shaped by social, economic, and political determinants that lead to health inequalities and injustices. A syndemic can result in very poor life outcomes, very poor well-being outcomes, and very poor outcomes in general for children who live in those communities, Bousset noted. She pointed out that most of the states that have implemented trigger bans, laws banning abortion that went into effect upon the reversal of Roe, and those considering them have some of the lowest child health outcomes and well-being outcomes in the country, a trend that will only be accelerated by this decision. For the U.S. as a whole, Bousset predicted the emergence of a permanent subclass of low-income people and communities of color who are going to be not only lacking access to reproductive health care, but all kinds of other health care. And then you're going to have children who grow up in these communities that have low access to all sorts of opportunities in addition to health care. And you're going to simply, for generations, just repeat the cycle of generational poverty, low economic mobility, and everything else that comes with that. And in another story about how the post-Roe world may reshape America, this from Axios, poll shows abortion bans reshape where young Americans choose to live. More than 6 in 10 young women and 5 in 10 young men say states' individual abortion laws will at least somewhat influence where they choose to live, according to a new Axios poll. Why it matters? Many states are banning or heavily restricting abortions after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The survey's findings suggest that may significantly influence where Americans age 18 to 29 are willing to attend college, move for work, or build families. The fact that people are going to change where they live based on something like this tells you how important they think it is. And in a little bit of pushback from the feds, this from the Associated Press, Biden administration says docs must offer abortion if mom's life is at risk. The Biden administration last Monday told hospitals that they must provide abortion services if the life of the mother is at risk, saying federal law and emergency treatment guidelines preempt state laws and jurisdictions that now ban the procedure without any exceptions following the Supreme Court's decision to end a constitutional right to abortion. The Department of Health and Human Services cited requirements on medical facilities in the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The law requires medical facilities to determine whether a person seeking treatment may be in labor or whether they face an emergency health situation or one that could develop into an emergency, and to provide treatment. The department said emergency conditions include ectopic pregnancy, complications of pregnancy loss, or emergent hypertensive disorders, such as preeclampsia with severe features. Currently, even the states with the most stringent bans on abortion do allow exceptions when the health of the mother is at risk, though the threat of prosecution has created much confusion for some doctors. And in another story, may show how another way that we may not be very well prepared for a post-Roe world. This from NPR. Why this key chance of getting permanent birth control is often missed. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, doctors say they're seeing a surge in the number of women who want to prevent unintended pregnancies by getting their tubes tied. But a lot of patients fail to actually get this surgery because an important window of opportunity during hospitalization right after childbirth is often missed. The reasons why range from two full operating rooms to paperwork problems. This has long been a source of frustration, and it's taken on new urgency now that the court's decision has created a sudden increased demand for this permanent, extremely effective method of birth control. Tubal surgery, which involves cutting, blocking, or removing the fallopian tubes that carry eggs, is the most commonly used form of contraception for women in the United States. But studies show that about 40 to 60% of women who had previously requested to have their tubes tied during a post-delivery hospital stay ended up not getting it done. These women face a high rate of subsequent pregnancy. About half of women who don't have their desired postpartum sterilization procedure will get pregnant in the next year, says Dr. Rachel Flink, an OB-GYN in upstate New York. Women could theoretically come back to the hospital another time, but this type of birth control is frequently requested by people who are poor, less educated, and lack insurance. They're more likely to fall into groups of people who have difficulty accessing the healthcare system later. When they're already in the hospital for the arrival of a newborn, someone is able to watch their baby, they've already made other childcare arrangements, there's no transportation issues, Flink says. So from a patient's point of view, this can be the best possible time for tubal surgery, especially if they only have public health insurance because of pregnancy and will lose it soon after childbirth. Yet many different barriers can stand in the way. Sometimes it's that the hospital operating rooms are just too full, so an elective procedure that doesn't seem like an emergency never makes it onto the schedule before a patient has to be discharged. Sometimes doctors think the patient is too overweight for the surgery, even though research suggests obesity doesn't pose an added risk. Sometimes a doctor might try to talk younger patients out of it, saying they might change their minds. If the hospital has a religious affiliation, the surgery might just be prohibited. And then there's one piece of paper that's especially problematic. It's a consent form required by Medicaid, which pays for nearly half of all birth hospitalizations in the United States. This form has to be signed at least 30 days before tubal surgery is done, explains Dr. Sonia Barrero, a researcher and physician with the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Basically, what it does is create a mandatory 30-day waiting period for people who rely on public funding for their health care, says Barrero, who notes that the waiting period is not required for private insurance, so it definitely creates a kind of two-tiered system. If a person on Medicaid signs a consent form too late or delivers unexpectedly early, or loses the form and it's not on file, then Medicaid won't pay for the operation. This does impact a significant number of people with Medicaid, says Barrero, whose research suggests that taking away Medicaid-related roadblocks to getting tubal surgery could prevent more than 29,000 unintended pregnancies each year. Okay, now I want to shift attention to gun violence prevention. Last month, there was a, quote, historic bill passed dealing with gun safety and gun violence prevention. But of course, given the scope of the problem, what it actually deals with on the gun front is actually rather minimal. And it's really actually, because Republicans demanded it, really a mental health bill. And most of the muscle and the money that goes towards mental health. Now, of course, that's welcome, but there's an open question about how that will actually affect gun violence. So this from Kaiser Health News. Gun safety wrapped in a mental health bill. A look at the health provisions in the new law. The gun safety law forged through tense bipartisan talks in the Senate last month has been heralded as the first federal legislation in 30 years to combat rising gun violence. But what often falls below the radar is that the new law focuses on improving mental health services. News coverage has largely centered on the law's provisions to enhance background checks for younger buyers, encourage states to implement their own red flag laws, and close the so-called boyfriend loophole. Less attention has been paid to the mental health programs, and most of the estimated $13 billion is earmarked for that. It is kind of a gun safety bill wrapped in a mental health bill, said Jeffrey Swanson, a psychiatry professor at the Duke University School of Medicine who studies the intersection of gun violence and mental illness. The pairing of these initiatives and the legislation spearheaded by a small group of senators after the May 24 school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, was a result of Republicans' insistence that any gun reform must also address mental health, even as Democrats disavowed a connection between the two concerns. We don't think you can solve America's gun violence epidemic through the prism of mental health, but if we have an agreement between Democrats and Republicans to spend billions of additional dollars on mental health treatment, especially for vulnerable communities, let's take that opportunity, said Senator Chris Murphy, a key negotiator, while laying out the bill's framework. While mental health advocates are happy Congress is authorizing new funds for their cause, they also expressed concern it could continue to perpetuate the idea that people with mental health disorders are largely responsible for gun violence, although research shows that's not the case. Only 3-5% of violent acts are committed by persons with serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disease, or major depression. People living with mental illness are more likely to be victims of violence than are members of the general population. It is with very mixed emotions when we think about lumping these together, said Hannah Wesolowski, Chief Advocacy Officer at the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We need mental health investments, yet we know that mental health is not the direct cause of a person being violent. A central question about this heightened level of investment is whether it can make a difference in the nation's struggle to combat gun violence. Here's a look at the key mental health aspects in the new law. What's in the legislation? The Congressional Budget Office estimates the new law's total cost to $13 billion, a large chunk of which will be used to increase funding to expand existing mental health and school safety service programs, including $1 billion over 5 years for two programs to boost the number of mental health counselors in schools. The new law also certifies up to $8.6 billion in funding over 10 years to support the build-out of certified community behavioral health clinics in every state in the U.S. These types of clinics, which already exist in 10 states as part of a pilot Medicaid program, are required to see people regardless of their insurance coverage and treat them for mental health or substance use disorders. States would need to apply to participate in the program, which would begin in 2024. Will it stem gun violence? It depends on how you define gun violence, said Swanson. Over half of gun deaths in the U.S. are suicides, and it's possible this legislation will help to reduce those deaths. The new law also provides funding for states, which can be used to implement red flag laws, which have been shown to reduce suicide rates. These types of laws, now in the books in 19 states and D.C., allow for family members, police, or doctors to petition the court to ask to temporarily remove guns for up to a year from people who they fear may be at risk of harming themselves or others. For example, Swanson led a research project analyzing how red flag policy worked in Connecticut, where his team estimated that for every 10 to 20 guns removed, one suicide was prevented. But experts acknowledge that the mental health spending may not do as much to stop the gun violence that's manifested through mass shootings, such as in Uvalde, at the supermarket in Buffalo, New York in May, and during a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois. The vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent, said Swanson. So this kind of focus, again, it's welcome to get increased mental health funding, but it's sort of a distraction that Republicans are putting in. Probably the programs that work better, that'd be more cost effective. There's specific violence interrupter programs that have been shown to be very effective. And the larger cultural issue, which is also a mental health issue, which shows up, I suppose, diagnostically very different in the mental health system, but culturally shows up as toxic masculinity, and is related to these violence interrupter programs in the sense that one part of toxic masculinity is this macho inability to de-escalate situations, and once lethal weapons are introduced, you often get lethal consequences. And of course, this legislation does very little to limit access to guns, particularly the most deadly, and the high-capacity magazines, and the access to younger people, which are at higher risk for doing these mass shootings. Okay, well, now I want to switch gears a bit, but I do want to stick in kind of the mental health field with psychology, but approach it from another angle as the solidity of the science for psychology. This from Mad in America. Psychology's, quote, winning streak is a failure of science, not success. The scientific method depends on the revision and rejection of failed theories. Somehow, psychology researchers always find a positive result. We contend the best option for fixing psychology's, quote, winning problem is the registered report format in which articles are accepted or rejected prior to knowing the results of the study. Scheele et al. Compared results reported in published registered reports and those of standard publications. They found 44% positive results in registered reports and 96% positive results in standard publications. When registered reports were used, publication bias, in which only positive studies end up in journals, dropped by a huge amount. He concludes, psychologists are willing to be wrong as long as they can still get a publication. Of course, science occurs in social, political, and economic situations, and this is a good example where it does not benefit good science to a large degree. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's switch to some health care news. A little spoiler alert, 4 out of 5 of these stories are not going in the right direction. But let's start with Medical Express. Risk factors in adults with cardiovascular disease are worsening over time despite advances in secondary prevention. Secondary prevention refers to prevention of recurrent cardiovascular events, such as a heart attack or stroke in individuals who already have cardiovascular disease. Risk factor profiles analyzed include blood glucose, blood pressure, cholesterol, body mass index, smoking, physical activity, and diet. All factors showed a worsening or unchanged trend except for cholesterol, which showed a modest improvement. However, only 30% of adults with cardiovascular disease had an ideal cholesterol profile in the study period 2015 to 2018. We're not really moving a needle on these risk factors, and that's leaving a lot of people at risk for recurrent events. Specifically, the new analysis showed regarding blood glucose, ideal profile trends fell from 59% in the early period of 1999 to 2002 to 52% in 2015 to 2018, with the worst profiles found among Asian adults. Regarding blood pressure, ideal levels fell after 2010, with 49% having an ideal profile in 2015 to 2018, with the worst profiles found among Black adults. Cholesterol, ideal profiles showed an overall increase from 7% to 30%, likely due to widespread use of lipid-lowering medication, but with a worsening trend among Hispanic adults. Body mass index, this measure of relative weight, saw an overall worsening ideal profile from 24% ideal in the earlier period to 18% in the more recent period. Smoking, physical activity, and dietary profiles showed no significant changes over time overall, but the analysis found worsening smoking trend among Black adults and improving trend for physical activity among Hispanic adults. So, of course, healthcare happens amidst all these larger, you know, social determinants of health and individual risk factors. But within the medical community, not able to mitigate much prevention, secondary prevention of people who've already been identified with frank cardiovascular disease. Okay, next up, another simple challenge with a relatively simple solution from Kaiser Health News. Hospital-acquired pneumonia is killing patients, yet there is a simple way to stop it. Hospital patients not getting their teeth brushed or not brushing their teeth themselves is believed to be a leading cause of hundreds of thousands of cases of pneumonia a year in patients who have not been put on a ventilator. Pneumonia is among the most common infections that occur in healthcare facilities, and a majority of cases are non-ventilator hospital-acquired pneumonia, which kills up to 30% of those infected. But unlike many infections that strike within hospitals, the federal government doesn't require us to report these cases. As a result, few hospitals understand the origin of the illness, track its occurrence, or actively work to prevent it, the experts said. Many cases of this non-ventilator hospital-acquired pneumonia could have be avoided if hospital staffers more dutifully brush the teeth of bedridden patients, according to a growing body of peer-reviewed research papers. Instead, many hospitals often skip teeth brushing to prioritize other tasks and provide only cheap, ineffective toothbrushes, often unaware of the consequences, says Dion Baker, a Sacramento State nursing professor who spent more than a decade studying this. I'll tell you that today the vast majority of the tens of thousands of nurses in hospitals have no idea that pneumonia comes from germs in the mouth, Baker said. Pneumonia occurs when germs trigger an infection in the lungs. Although the non-ventilator hospital-acquired pneumonia accounts for most of the cases associated with healthcare, it historically has not received the same attention as pneumonia tied to ventilators, which is easier to identify and study because it occurs among a narrow subset of patients. The non-ventilator hospital-acquired pneumonia, a risk for virtually all hospital patients, is often caused by bacteria from the mouth that gathers in the scummy biofilm on unbrushed teeth and is aspirated into the lungs. Patients face a higher risk if they lie flat or remain immobile for long periods. So it can be also be prevented by elevating their heads and getting them out of bed more often. According to the National Organization for Non-Ventilator Hospital-Acquired Pneumonia Prevention, which was founded in 2020, this pneumonia infects about 1 in every 100 hospital patients and kills 15 to 30% of them. For those who survive, the illness often extends their hospital stay by up to 15 days and makes it much more likely they will be readmitted within a month or transferred to an intensive care unit. We are not asking for some big $300,000 piece of equipment, Baker said. The two things that show the best evidence of preventing this harm are things that should be happening in standard care anyway: brushing teeth and getting patients mobilized. Okay, well, let's switch and do the good news story in the middle of these not-so-great stories. This from Science Daily. U.S. hospitals' adverse events drop significantly. The largest medical record-based study ever of adverse events suffered by hospitalized patients in the U.S., published in the July 12th issue of JAMA, reports a significant decrease in the rate of adverse events over the last decade. The study findings hold promise for both the safety of patients and the effectiveness of hospital patient safety initiatives. The researchers report the rate of adverse events declined significantly between 2010 and 2019 in patients admitted for acute myocardial infarction, heart failure, pneumonia, and major surgical procedures. Some of the adverse events captured include adverse drug events, hospital-acquired infections, procedural complications, pressure ulcers, and falls. Researchers evaluated the in-hospital trends in the number of adverse events per 1,000 hospitalizations. For example, adverse events among patients who experience heart attacks declined significantly over the decade from 218 per 1,000 in 2010 to 139 per 1,000 in 2019. In heart failure patients, adverse events dropped from 168 to 116. In pneumonia patients, from 195 to 119. And in major surgery patients, from 204 to 130. Interestingly, the researchers observed larger improvements in the adverse event rate in older patients than in younger ones, and there were few apparent differences in risk based on patients' race, ethnicity, sex, or region of care in the U.S. All groups saw similar reductions. Now, I must note that I've reported on these adverse events before, and the trends haven't been particularly good, but this is a really good study that actually looks at the medical records, not just billing data. Like, some of the earlier studies were based on like Medicare billing data, and that doesn't always capture the underlying health condition as accurately. So this is good news. Next up from Stat News, not such great news. Inaccurate pulse oximeter readings tied to less supplemental oxygen for darker-skinned ICU patients. Patients with darker skin who receive less accurate readings of their oxygen levels using pulse oximeters, the ubiquitous devices clamped on hospitalized patients' fingers, also received less supplemental oxygen during ICU stays, according to a study. The new research in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine adds to the evidence that the faulty readings in darker-skinned patients can affect their care and may be one factor explaining racial disparities, such as higher rates of limb loss and death for Black and Hispanic ICU patients. Meanwhile, a different study published in the British Medical Journal suggests that imperfect readings from pulse oximeters may impact care of Black patients broadly, not merely those who are critically ill. An analysis of medical records of tens of thousands of general and surgical patients in Veterans Health Administration medical records showed that Black patients were more likely than white patients to have hidden hypoxia, that is, undetected low oxygen levels linked to higher rates of death and organ failure. 15.6% of white patients had hidden hypoxia, while 19.6% of Black patients did. Another way to put that is that Black patients are 26% more likely to have this hidden hypoxia. This is hundreds of thousands of patients being affected, and that's just at one hospital system, said Valeria Valbuena, a general surgery resident at the University of Michigan and the study's lead author. This is literally affecting millions of patients. In their study, they noted that the VA, the nation's largest integrated health system, could be a major driver of improving the devices if it insisted on buying only devices that worked equally well on veterans of all skin colors. The critical question of how large a role imprecision in the devices plays in health disparities is being debated. Some doctors and device manufacturers have pushed back against the criticism of pulse oximeters, arguing that patients may be undergoing unnecessary and painful arterial blood draws because of concerns over accuracy of the devices, and others have questioned the high cost of redesigning and replacing current devices. Every 10 years, this issue raises its ugly head and nothing gets done, Valbuena says. People say it's going to be cumbersome. That suggests that because the problem is in black patients, it's not worth fixing. The FDA announced on June 21st that it will convene its Medical Devices Advisory Committee later this year to discuss concerns about how well the devices work in patients with darker skin. In the meantime, many physicians are relying more on arterial blood gas measurements, which are more painful to collect, and telling darker skin patients who rely on home pulse oximeters to call their physicians at any sign of shortness of breath, regardless of what the devices indicate. Well, next up, I have probably the most fascinating healthcare story today. This from one of my favorite investigative journalist organizations, ProPublica. Pharma companies sue for the right to buy blood from Mexicans along border. In the year since the United States blocked Mexicans from entering the country to sell their blood, the two global pharmaceutical companies that operate the largest number of plasma clinics along the border say they've seen a sharp drop in supply. In a suit challenging the ban, the companies acknowledge for the first time the extent to which Mexicans visiting the U.S. on short-term visas contribute to the world supply of blood plasma. In court filings, the companies revealed that up to 10% of the blood plasma collected in the U.S., millions of liters a year, came from Mexicans who crossed the border with visas that allowed brief visits for business and tourism. ProPublica reported in 2019 that thousands of Mexicans were crossing the border to donate blood as often as twice a week, earning as much as $400 per month. Selling blood has been illegal in Mexico since 1987. Many countries place strict limits on blood donations. Germany, for example, allows a maximum of 60 donations per year, with intensive checkups before every fifth donation. But the Food and Drug Administration doesn't require comparable donor checkups and allows people visiting American clinics to sell their blood twice a week or up to 104 times a year. The limits that other countries set on blood donations have made the U.S. one of the world's leading exporters of blood. In 2020, U.S. facilities collected 38 million liters of plasma for the production of medicine, accounting for approximately 60% of the blood plasma collected worldwide. Well, folks, we usually think of Imperial America as sucking the blood, the lifeblood of those around the world, but nope, we managed to suck it out of the poor and desperate, often, who are plasma donors trying to raise a few bucks, giving up their lifeblood in exchange for cash. And now it's coming back with our anti-immigrant policies that we may be creating a small healthcare problem, perhaps a large one. Very complicated. But should we be surprised that pharmaceutical companies are trying to increase access to blood plasma from immigrants? Or in this case, Mexicans crossing the border temporarily for that purpose. Okay, well, let's move to another vulnerable population. That would be disabled folks in America. This from NPR. Department of Justice fails to report on making federal websites accessible to disabled people. About a quarter of Americans live with a disability, but nearly a third of the most popular federal websites are difficult for disabled people to access. It has been 10 years since the Department of Justice filed a so-called biennial report on the federal government's compliance with accessibility standards for information technology, a bipartisan group of concerned senators say. Under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, the federal government is required to make all of its websites accessible to disabled people and to publicly report on its compliance with accessibility standards every 2 years. Website accessibility means that a website has been designed with the needs of people with disabilities in mind so anyone can navigate that website, says Ashley Johnson, who is a senior policy analyst for the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. This can include making sure the websites can work well with assistive technology devices such as screen readers that read aloud content and screen magnifiers that enlarge content. It is unclear why the DOJ stopped issuing these biennial reports, as well as whether it collected Section 508 compliance data or issued recommendations more recently than 2012. Questions remain on whether the DOJ has the resources and personnel necessary to comply with the law and issue these reports, and what it plans to begin and when it plans to begin meeting the reporting requirement. The senator said they want answers regarding the situation by July 29th. Within the U.S., 26% of Americans live with a disability, yet a 2021 report by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation found that 30% of the most popular federal websites do not pass an automated accessibility test for their homepage, and 48% of those sites failed the test on at least one of their three most popular pages. Without accessible websites and other information technology, people with disabilities aren't treated equally under the law. The fact that the DOJ hasn't reported on the federal government's compliance over the last decade speaks to a larger issue of disabled people not being prioritized by society at large. We're also used to having information at our fingertips, literally on our phones, but if you have a disability and you can't get that information from the agencies, yikes. It just flies in the face of not just transparency, but what our society has come to expect in terms of the ability for people to access information. So we look forward to the DOJ's answers, and those answers will help us get a better sense of what's happening and what the next steps have to be taken. Okay, well, next up, a little bit better news. This from the Associated Press. Relaxed methadone rules appear safe, researchers find. As the coronavirus pandemic shut down the nation in March of 2020, the U.S. government told methadone clinics they could allow stable patients with opioid addiction to take their medicine at home unsupervised. Methadone, an opioid itself, can be dangerous in large amounts, and most patients are required to take the liquid medicine daily at clinics. It wasn't clear whether the relaxed take-home policy would cause more harm than good. Now, a new study of fatal overdoses from January 2019 to August 2021 suggests that easing access was safe. It did not lead to more deaths involving the treatment drug. The share of overdose deaths involving methadone declined from 4.5% in January 2019 to 3.2% in August 2021, the study found. The findings may help make the change permanent, wrote the authors, who are U.S. government researchers from the CDC and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. More than 400,000 people in the United States take methadone as part of their treatment for addiction to opioids, such as heroin, fentanyl, and painkillers. Methadone, when used correctly, can stop drug cravings without causing a high. Okay, next up, a Parkinson's story. This from Science Daily. Death rate from Parkinson's rising in U.S., study finds. A new study shows that in the last two decades, the death rate from Parkinson's disease has risen about 63% in the United States. The research is published in Neurology, the medical journal of the American Academy of Neurology. The study found that the death rate was twice as high in men as in women, and there was a higher death rate in white people than other racial ethnic groups. We know that people are living longer and the general population is getting older, but that doesn't fully explain the increase we saw in the death rate in people with Parkinson's, study author Wei Bao, who conducted the research at the University of Iowa, said. Understanding why more people are dying from this disease is critical if we are going to reverse the trend. The study looked at a national death registry that included 480,000 people who died of Parkinson's between 1999 and 2019. After adjusting for age, researchers found that the number of people who died from the disease increased 63% from 5.4 per 100,000 people in 1999 to 8.8 per 100,000 people in 2019. The average annual increase was 2.4% over those 20 years. Researchers found mortality increased significantly across all age groups, both sexes, various racial and ethnic groups, and different urban-rural classifications. However, death rates were twice as high in men as in women. Bao says one possible explanation for this sex difference is that estrogen, which leads to higher dopamine levels in parts of the brain that control motor responses, may protect women from developing Parkinson's. White people were more likely to die from Parkinson's than other racial and ethnic groups. In 2019, the death rate for white people was 9.7, followed by Hispanic people at 6.5 and non-Hispanic black people at 4.7. Bao said previous studies have shown that compared to white people, black and Hispanic people are less likely to see an outpatient neurologist due to socioeconomic barriers, suggesting that white people may have a higher chance of receiving a Parkinson's diagnosis. It's important to continue to evaluate long-term trends in Parkinson's death rates, Bao said. This can inform future research that may help pinpoint why more people are dying of the disease. Also, updating vital statistics about Parkinson's death rates may be used for priority setting and financing of healthcare and policy. A limitation of the study is that only one underlying cause of death was recorded on each death certificate, so only people who are recorded as having died of Parkinson's were included in the study. This may not accurately reflect the prevalence of the disease as a cause of death. Well, that's a very interesting story, partly because it runs counter to some of the more obvious common trends that happen in public health, where racial ethnic minorities have higher health disparities, and women often do worse than men on some things. I mean, but I wanted to basically use that story as really an intro to this next story. Now, this next story is one comparing why women tend to age better and outlive men. Now, women have kind of had a short shrift run here recently, particularly in this post-Roe world. So I've had this story for quite a while, and I think it's a good time to drop it. So there it is from Medical Express. In most ways, women age better than men and live longer. Scientists are trying to figure out why. Consider 100 baby boys and 100 baby girls born in 1950. Experts predict that 46 of these men and 61 of the women, a third more, will still be alive at age 80 in 2030. Even Stephen Austin, an expert on aging at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, didn't give statistics like that much thought until about 10 years ago. Everyone knew that women outlived men. He figured it was just because men had more heart disease. But Austin, who is senior scientific director of the American Federation for Aging Research, is a sucker for topics that others take for granted, and he dug deeper. He learned that girls started out surviving boys even before they were born, and that their survival advantage lasted throughout life. It was present in virtually every country, rich or poor. Women were likely to live through natural disasters, famines, pandemics, including COVID-19, and many of the diseases that most often kill human beings. Under almost any condition we can imagine, women do better, he said. A rare upside for men was that those who made it to their senior years were less disabled than female peers. There were also surprising studies that found that a few drugs that extended the life of male mice did nothing for females. That's a really stunning result, said Richard Miller, a biogerontologist who directs the Center for Aging Research at the University of Michigan and has been studying life-extending drugs in mice. One medication, he said, worked in both sexes. I might add that if it extends the life of rats, maybe that affects men more than women. Sorry, couldn't resist that one. Austin and a growing cadre of researchers started to think that these differences in aging between men and women were fundamental to human biology and potentially much more complex and divergent than many had assumed. They are now in the early stages of studying how our chromosomes and genes, hormones, and immune systems influence how long and how well we live, with an eye towards expanding our healthy lifespans. If we could find a way to make men live as long as women and make women be as healthy as men later in life, then we could have enormous impact on our lives, Austin said. Candace Kerr, a stem cell biologist in the Division of Aging Biology at the National Institute on Aging, agreed that understanding those sex differences could improve the health of both men and women as they aged. It paves the way for finding sex-specific targets for disease, she said. For decades, scientists assumed that information they gleaned from male patients and male lab animals would naturally apply to females as well. Since 2016, the National Institutes of Health has required scientists to incorporate males and females into the design, analysis, and reporting of clinical research studies of people and vertebrate animals. Now researchers are finding unexpected differences throughout our bodies, but they say it's too soon to draw sweeping conclusions. I think that we're in a renaissance of sorts in really beginning to understand and appreciate the differences, said Dana Dubal, a neurologist at the University of California, San Francisco, who studies how to slow aging with a focus on hormones and genetics. Her research has found fascinating evidence of the benefits women may derive from their second X chromosome. The signs that women are the tougher sex when it comes to health are copious. 85% to 90% of centenarians are women. All of the world's 10 oldest people with credible birth records were female. In 2018, women died at the lower age-adjusted rate of 13 of the top 15 causes of death, according to the National Center for Health Statistics. There was no sex difference for stroke. Women were more likely to die of Alzheimer's disease, although men who get dementia die of it more quickly, said Michelle Milkey, a Mayo Clinic epidemiologist who studies sex differences in neurodegeneration. Women tend to die of the same basic things that men do, but they die at later ages, Miller said. At the cellular level, women's brains look four or five years younger than men's, Dubal said. Many biological markers indicate faster aging in almost all the tissues in male bodies, Kerr said. Women get heart disease later. Their vascular health is generally better than men's, although they have more disease in small blood vessels late in life, Milkey said. Women's immune systems respond more quickly to viral invasions. This is one explanation for why they're more likely to recover. It may also be why they're more prone to autoimmune diseases than men. When we come to what Austin calls the morbidity-mortality paradox. Men who survive into late middle age and old age tend to have less disability than women. One theory is that men die of diseases that women survive, but the women do not emerge unscathed. Many women will survive and remain fairly functional after diseases that men would have died from, Miller said. Ann Newman, a geriatrician and epidemiologist at the University of Pittsburgh, added that women are more prone to arthritis, which causes disability. Everyone loses muscle with age, and women start out with weaker muscles and a higher percentage of body fat. Women are also more prone to osteoporosis after menopause, and that puts them at risk for broken hips. There are more older women with frailty, partly because frail men didn't live that long. Women are just physically less endowed to keep moving as they get older, Newman said. As to why women live longer, the theories are many and complex. The gap between male and female lifespan widened during the 20th century. Caleb Finch, a biologist at the University of Southern California who studied that phenomenon, thought lung cancer and heart disease accounted for most of the difference. He also studied an indigenous Bolivian population whose pre-industrial lifestyle included exercise and a healthy diet. People there had very little coronary artery disease, but men still had more evidence of blood vessel damage than women. Newman added that women began living longer when better medical care meant they less often bled to death or became infected during childbirth. She thinks that qualities that allow women to successfully carry a child, such as the ability to tolerate stress and store additional nutrition, may lengthen their lifespans. You can't ignore behavior. Men are more likely to smoke and eat fatty food. They're also more likely to see doctors, also less likely to see doctors regularly and get cancer screenings and flu and COVID-19 vaccines. They more often age in isolation. Behavior feels like more than half the picture, said Arunsari Howell, a Temple Health geriatrician. Young men are prone to risky and potentially deadly activities, a period that Austin calls testosterone dementia. Their death rate compared to women slows after 35 or so, but it's still higher. Finch said trying to tease out what's affecting our aging is like analyzing a horde of arrows shot into the air at the same time, but traveling at different rates. Genes and hormones matter, but the role of culture and society in shaping the outcomes is also huge and not easy to define at a molecular level. Two X's may be better than one. Beyond behavior, much current research focuses on hormones and sex chromosomes. Women have two X chromosomes, one from their mother and one from their father. Men have an X from their mother and the Y from their father. Those two X's give women a richer dose of X-related genes. In each cell of a woman's body, one X dominates and the other is mostly inactivated, but it's not always the same X. Early in life, the mom and dad's X may split and work fairly evenly, but as women age, the fitter X may take a bigger role, Austin said. Plus, scientists now know that the inactivated X isn't really inactivated. About 15% of its genes are functional. Austin thinks the Y deserves more attention than scientists are giving it, but it's clear that it codes for many fewer genes, 55, than the X, 900. While the second X may give a woman a safety net of sorts if one of their X's is faulty, the man's Y chromosome is not much help when there's a problem with his X. This is why certain X-line diseases such as Fragile X syndrome, hemophilia A, and Duchenne muscular dystrophy are more common in men. Dubal's work with mice suggests that women's extra X complexity also give women a longevity advantage. She used a technique that allowed researchers to grow the gonads of one sex in the bodies of another, thus exposing them to the other's sex hormones. So genetically female mice could have testicles and penises, and male mice could have ovaries and vaginas. She compared four groups of mice, XX mice with ovaries, XX mice with testicles, XY mice with testicles, and XY mice with ovaries. The XX mice live the longest, regardless of their gonads. The X accounts for about 5% of her genome, Dubal says, and it is rich in brain-related genes. This may help explain why women are more cognitively resilient. One of her studies found that 19 of those genes were associated with slower cognitive aging in women, but not in men. Three genes, meanwhile, were linked to higher levels in men, but not women, a misformed Tau, a protein seen in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. What about hormones? Women may reap the benefits of the double dose of X throughout their lives, but there's little doubt that things go downhill from an aging perspective after menopause, so hormones are clearly also a factor. Estrogen, the most important female hormone, drops markedly as a woman enters menopause. Testosterone production also slows in men. Estrogens are thought to be protective against a variety of diseases, whereas testosterone seems to enhance the risk of disease progression, wrote Berenice Benayona, geneticist and cell biologist at the University of Southern California's School of Gerontology. The average woman reaches menopause at 51. Study shows that later menopause is associated with longer life. Jennifer Garrison, a neuroscientist and chemist at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, focuses on the impact of ovarian aging in women. Menopause makes a woman's body age about 6% faster, she said. It unleashes this negative cascade of health effects, including more heart disease, cognitive decline, and bone weakening. She said the ovaries are involved in important communication channels with the brain that have systemic physical implications. She would like to do away with menopause entirely. There's no biological imperative to have it, she said. She thinks menopause should be a choice, not something imposed on you by some out-of-date biology. She realizes that not every woman dreams of extra decades of periods and pregnancy fears. Pregnancy and fertility and menstruation can particularly be uncoupled from having functioning ovaries, she said. No doubt it will take a while to figure out how to do that, and there's no familiar, similar fix available to aging men. In the meantime, Temples Howell counsels male and female patients differently. She tells the men to worry about heart disease and high-fat diets. Women need to worry about preventing osteoporosis and falls. And we can all do the usual things that promote healthier aging. Eat good food, avoid smoking, and exercise. Okay, well that brings us to the bonus article section of the show, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. 14 this week. First up, 1. Post-Roe, many autoimmune patients lose access to the gold standard drug. 2. U.S. tells pharmacists not to withhold pills that can cause abortion, warning that failing to dispense such drugs may be discriminating on the basis of sex or disability, citing other conditions that they can treat. 3. Abortion laws spark profound changes in other medical care. 4. Dr. Caitlin Bernard was meant to write this with me before she was attacked for doing her job. So Dr. Caitlin Bernard was the physician that performed the abortion on the 10-year-old Ohioan and is being attacked. 5. What will happen if doctors defy the law to provide abortions? Laws favor conscientious refusers of care rather than conscientious providers of care. 6. What it costs to have a baby in the U.S. On average, $18,865. 7. Conservative blocs unleash litigation to curb public health powers. 8. Cooking them to death, the lethal toll of hot prisons, many of which don't have air conditioners, and climate change is boiling over. 9. American Nurses Association apologizes for racism, past and present. A good start. 10. The four bases of anti-science beliefs and what to do about them, as political divisions have potent effects on attitudes. 11. The new 988 mental health hotline is live. Here's what you need to know. I've reported on this a lot before, so you can now dial 988 for a mental health hotline and hopefully get a live counselor. It's kind of spotty, though, throughout the country. If they try to hook you up with the people closest to you, but if they don't answer the phone, it goes to these backup hotlines. So it's still working out, but today you can call 988 for a mental health hotline. 12. Spirituality linked with better health outcomes and patient care. 13. Many cancer centers push too many tests, so be careful what they're promoting if they're selling something. 14. And last but not least, some good news. You get goosebumps from the data. Hopes rise for a new malaria vaccine. The disease is a leading killer of children under 5 across Africa, but trials for a new vaccine suggest an end to the death toll could be in sight. You can view these stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-